KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. The Puget Sound region's been called one of America's least church-going areas, but are there aspects of organized religion that might benefit the non-religious? The Interfaith Amigos join us ahead. We also welcome our gardening panel just after 10:30. Late last week, the state of Washington told the Seattle Public Schools they had to fix problems in the special education programs or face state intervention. KUOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld joins us now. And Ann, I know you have been covering problems with special education in the Seattle district for quite some time. Why is the state involved in this?
Well, special ed is funded by the federal government, and federal law requires that public schools use that money to serve every student, no matter how severe their disability. And the state is in charge of disbursing those federal special ed dollars and also in charge of monitoring how well districts are adhering to that federal law. So I spoke to Doug Gill, who's director of special ed for the state, and he says that Seattle has been noncompliant in so many areas of the law for so many years in a row now that the district has demonstrated that it needs help in order to serve students properly. And Gill said that no other large district in the state seems to have the same degree of problems that Seattle does in special ed. And this is the first time the state has ever issued what it calls a comprehensive corrective action plan for a district.
Are there any areas in particular that stand out as shortfall areas?
Yeah, they're pretty much breaking it down into three main areas, the state is. Those findings really correspond to the complaints that I've heard from parents and teachers for years now. The state found that the district lacks a standardized system of delivering special ed services. It just isn't really organized appropriately. And the state found that principals at individual schools can interpret federal law differently and thus treat special ed really differently. Parents have often told me that their child might get certain supports one year and then a new principal comes to the school and the kid might get only a fraction of the help that they were getting the year before because of that principal's understanding of the law or philosophy. And third, the state found that the district has failed to find and keep qualified people at the head of the district's special ed department. In the past 5 years, the district has gone through 8 different people at the helm of special ed. That's right, 8 in 5 years. And some of them didn't really have much of a background in special ed at all.
Wow. Well, is that because the job is so hard that they left just because the district's had leadership turnover itself?
I think that it's both. I mean, when it comes to special ed, you have a lot of people who need a lot of special services, and what services they need is up for debate. You're going to get a lot of frustrated parents, you know, some rightly, some not, and that's going to be hard to deal with. But at the same time, the district has had a lot of leadership churn in all of its departments.
Now, Superintendent Bonda took over last summer, not quite a year ago. Has he made particular changes to the special education program?
Yeah, he came in and said that special ed was a priority for him, and one of his main goals as superintendent was to find a qualified and dedicated and going to stick around for a while head of special ed. And he has done that. At least he's found someone qualified. We'll see whether she sticks around. Let's hope. She was recently hired, and the district has also come out with the framework for a new delivery system. But that is still a work in progress.
Well, so what does the state want in addition to what the district is already doing?
Right. So the state did ask the district to overhaul its special ed delivery plan and also to create an organized system for decision making and oversight in the special ed department, to do that same hire and retain the steady leaders, and also to set aside a chunk of money to comply with the state's demands.
Wow. There's about $11 million at stake. What happens? First of all, how long does Seattle have to show that it's making progress?
The state's given the district 18 months, and that was of, I believe, April 1st. So they have 18 months, and they've said, we can pull $11 million of your federal special ed funding. But of course, who's going to do that? You want special ed to improve in a district. You don't starve them of funding. So what Doug Gill at the state told me is probably a more likely outcome would be, if the district doesn't comply, that the state would take over the district's special ed department. Not something that's happened before, not something that anyone wants to happen. And Doug Gill said that he thinks that the district is going to get its act together within 18 months. He expects full compliance and is optimistic.
Do you know how many special ed students are served by Seattle Public Schools at this point? Do you have a rough idea?
It's about 1 in 7 students is getting special ed services. And I mean, for some kids, that can be as little as, you know, some speech therapy to correct a lisp. So, you know, when people think of special ed, they might just think of, you know, one type of disability. But it's a whole range. And some kids are only getting it for, you know, maybe 6 months. And some kids will get it their entire school career.
So theoretically, the state could stop that flow of money. But because we're talking about kids here, that isn't really at stake.
Not people to starve of money. No. I think that it's more likely that the state would kind of exert more of its influence in how the district's running special ed. But I think that the district's already underway and meeting some of these requirements.
So essentially, that's the district response to what the state has said. Look, we've got this. Give us the 18 months to show you that it can work.
Yeah, I think that the district seems to be complying so far.
Well, I know that this is something that you've been covering and will continue to cover. We're just about over with the school year ends next week. So really, there's sort of that lull in there. And come September, we'll see really what changes have come into play.
Well, there will be some action over the summer because one of the main factors in special ed is how much support students are getting in the classroom. And one of the things that a lot of teachers have been requesting, both special ed teachers and general education teachers, is more instructional assistance in the classroom. And the number of IAs in helping those individual kids can let a kid, say, with autism work more effectively in a classroom with general education peers. So that's going to be part of the contract negotiation process between the teachers and the district, and also the principals are negotiating their contract this year. So there'll be rumblings over the summer of what's going to change in special ed, and I'm looking forward to covering it.
I will be looking forward to hearing your reports, as always. Ann Dornfeld is the education reporter for KUOW News. Thank you so much for coming in today.
My pleasure.
This is Weekday.
It's 10:14. In a minute, hear a conversation about how some elements of organized religion might, just might, be useful for non-religious folks. That's just ahead.
Support for KUOW comes from Sodo Hydro, specializing in indoor and outdoor organic garden supplies and hydroponics, featuring organic bison soil, sanctuary soils, and cutting-edge solutions, located south of the stadiums. Product information at sodohydro.com.
It's sunny in Seattle and 66 degrees. Forecast says expect sun all day with a high of 77. And tomorrow, Wednesday, is going to wind up sunny again with a high of 74. It's 10:15 and we're gardening on a sunny day in 15 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. Many people in our region are religious and many are not. The Interfaith Amigos are here to share the teachings, meditations, or practices from their religious traditions that might be a positive addition to all of our lives, even people who are not religious. Imam Jamal Rahman is co-founder, Muslim Sufi minister at the Interfaith Community Sanctuary and adjunct faculty at Seattle University. Rabbi Ted Falcon is teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. He's also the founder of Makom Or Shalom, a synagogue in Los Angeles, and Beit Aleph Meditative Synagogue in Seattle. And Pastor Don McKenzie is a former minister and head of staff at the University Congregational United Church of Christ in Seattle. Thanks, all three of you, for coming in again.
Thank you. Katie.
I thought we could start by going around the circle, and perhaps each of you could pick one thought or practice from your different faith traditions that you think would be of the most benefit to a person who is not religious, or maybe even not spiritual. Who wants to start?
That's a great question. Yeah. There's a book, I forgot the author, called Religion for Atheists, where he's talking about the things, aspects that come up in religious traditions that can be helpful to people who have no interest or any affiliation in any particular religion. But you ask it in terms of Judaism to me, and I would say, you know, The most important holiday in Jewish tradition is Shabbat, is the Sabbath that comes every week. And the whole idea of Shabbat is to take a moment out of trying to make something happen, trying to do something, and experience a time of fulfillment. You know, how what we've done is enough. We can just allow it to be and find ways of celebrating creation, celebrating who we are, celebrating who we're with, celebrating what we're doing, which doesn't mean we're at an end. We're not finished, but we can take a pause and regain the strength we need to, out of blessing, to go ahead and continue our evolution. So one of the ways we celebrate Shabbat is we welcome Shabbat with light. And what I would suggest, if I were to give one practice, it would be find a time during your week or find times during your week where either alone or with your partner or with your friends or with your family, you sit around and light a candle. And around the light of the candle, you talk about what you're grateful for this week. You talk even about the challenges you've had this week. You know, you take that time with the light of a candle to remember, to share the things that are important with those who are around you, and take that light into your heart and let it expand and let it awaken the deep love of our being. Take it into your mind and let it awaken the wisdom that we contain. And let that light be a reminder of the light that we can share with others wherever we might be. So I would encourage lighting candle and having it be a participatory event without any, you know, okay, if it's not linked to any specific tradition or religion, great. But take a moment and have a Shabbat.
That's beautiful.
Great. Shabbat shalom.
Indeed.
Jamal, do you want to go next?
Yes, I want to. I'd like to. I feel that the goal of a non-religious person is the same as that of a religious person. So what is the purpose of religion, really? Certainly all the sages have said that it's twofold. One is, can I become a better person? Can I evolve into the fullness of my being? Can I align my personality, as the a religious person would say, or certainly in the monotheistic tradition, with my soul, with my higher self? A non-religious person would say, I just want to become a more complete human being. That's one. The second purpose is, can I be of service? A person who's religious will say, to God's creation. Or a non-religious person will say to humanity, to the earth, to the animals. So to be of service, to be a lamp, a lifeboat, or a ladder. So for me, a very beautiful practice would be, how can I become a more complete, developed human being so I can be of authentic service to others? I remember again the words of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. He said, a great primary work in this world for the human being is to die before you die. Meaning, die to your false self, your ego, before you die a physical death. So you become a more complete human being. So the practice is, in the Sufi tradition, is that you always carry a piece of paper with you. In the course of the day, whenever you become aware of an ego trait in you, I became angry. Make a note of that. Write it down. If you become aware of a, whatever you want to call that, a divine quality, a higher self quality, I was compassionate, write that down. At the end of the day, before sleeping, look at that piece of paper and shine the light of awareness on those ego qualities that you became aware of, on the higher self qualities you became aware of, and express gratitude that you shine the light on both of them, and just ask that may this light diminish my ego qualities and may this light grow my divine quality. So it really is what you were saying, Ted. It's really an expression of gratitude that I have become aware in the course of the day what were the ego qualities, what were the divine qualities, and know that just by shining the light of awareness is going to diminish that which needs to be diminished and grow that which needs to grow. That is a beautiful practice, I feel.
Pastor Don McKenzie?
You know, I think you might expect a Christian to say Christmas or Easter or something like that. But I like the direction we're going because I think it's for two reasons. One, it's enormously important that people who have not felt connected would have a way of connecting, not to the particulars necessarily, but to the universals that they point to. And so I'm going to suggest that Lent in Christianity, which is kind of a Shabbat writ large, it's a season of the year prior to Easter, prior to Holy Week, rather, where really the substance of Shabbat is a way of framing the kinds of things that Rabbi Ted's been talking about and the kinds of things that Imam Jamal has been talking about. The noise and chaos of life is so great, and so much of the things that we encounter on a daily basis tend to numb us rather than help us to grow. I like the idea of lighting a candle daily during Lent and making those notes that Jamal has talked about. Was this an experience that really helped me to grow, or was it just another one of that endless chain of things that really numb me? And the experience of feeling numb is a source of frustration and anger for so many people. And we all feel for that. And just these practices, I think, can be healing. And again, we're not saying that people would need to become Jewish or Muslim or Christian, but these are particulars in our traditions that point to ways to grow and to experience a kind of healing that everybody needs.
So I thought I'd also ask you each to share one practice that you've added to your life from outside of your traditions. It could be from each other's or something else you've picked up, but that has been a useful tradition in your daily lives.
I was really good friends with the late Catholic mystic, Brother Wayne Teasdale. And he had come to a community and he talked at great length about centering prayer. And he had requested that no matter what practices we do, including the Islamic body prayer, could we also incorporate the centering prayer? So he taught us that particular method. And I have found that to be very, very effective. It deepens my silence. It is not dissimilar from some Islamic practices I know, but it enriches it. It enhances it, adds a new dimension to it. So I love to repeat an Islamic mantra, repeat it again and again and again, and then when I usher into the state of grace, I become very quiet. And that, for me, is the centering prayer. And I'm very grateful to Brother Wayne Teasdale, my Catholic friend, for having taught us and myself and our community this beautiful prayer.
Don, do you have one?
Well, I'm just thinking that early in the time we started meeting together over the last 12 years, I think the concept of gratitude became immediately an important issue. And the way it can provide healing and a frame of mind and spirit that is very helpful instead of destructive. At some point, though, Rabbi Ted, who repeatedly quoted Meister Eckhart in the Christian tradition, who said, "If all you did every day was say thank you, that would be a great spiritual practice." And then proceeded to tell Jamal and me about a prayer in the Jewish tradition that Ted translated from the Hebrew as, "I thank you, living and eternal being, for you have mercifully restored my soul within me. Your faithfulness is great." My wife Judy and I say that every day and every morning, and it helps to frame the day.
I'm speaking with the Interfaith Amigos. That was Pastor Don McKenzie, Rabbi Ted Falkins here, and Imam Jamal Rahman. We're talking about what religious teachings or practices could actually benefit people who are not religious or spiritual. And what about you, Ted? Is there something you added from outside of your faith tradition?
I think very early I added chanting from the Hindu tradition, you know, which originally I learned through Sanskrit chants. And I applied that to Hebrew chants so that one of the chants that I've led groups in for 40 years is chanting the Hebrew word shalom, You know, but that's a variant of the Sanskrit word Om. And we even, at certain points, combined Hebrew and Sanskrit and chanted Shalom Shanti Om, or Ahava. Ahava means love in Hebrew. Ananda means love, bliss in Sanskrit. Chanting Ananda Ahava, or simply Ahava. You know, so chant, which is really important to me, particularly when working with groups, is a practice that I incorporated from the Hindu tradition.
Hmm. Now, for people who are listening, who are rather wary of religious organizations, why should they listen to you about thinking about adding these practices into their lives?
I think Pastor Don and Imam Jamal both talked about the goals of religion being to help us become better human beings. So it's the same question of why do anything, you know? Religion has the problem of having become institutionalized and having the issues that all institutions have, namely the institution takes over and often eclipses the very thing the institution was founded for. But all of us are striving to become better human beings. All of us are striving to find our way, to find ways of loving better, to find ways of living better, to find ways of acting more compassionately. And all of us are, in one way or another, trying to find more clearly what is our purpose and what is our meaning in our lives, given our finite existence and given our challenges that all of us face. I think there is incredible wisdom to be found in religious traditions. I don't think finding that wisdom and even applying it to your life demands either conversion to that religion or membership in any particular religious institution. I think the wisdom is available, and I think it could benefit all of us.
I just want to say, at the very least, for those, for example, who have who work in corporations and don't want to look at religions, I'm making an assumption here, but let's say they are averse to any religion, at the corporate level, at the very least, it will reduce your stress and also increase your productivity just by doing what each tradition says: become silent and listen.
Do you want to add anything?
Well, I was just thinking about, you know, there are various reasons why people wouldn't be religious in this year, as opposed to, say, 100 years ago, when more people would have at least identified with a tradition. And I think it's probably helpful, as we think about this, and we've talked about this, that some people are not religious because they've been hurt by the institution. Some people are not religious because they've observed the management of the institution having eclipsed its substance, as Ted was talking about. And some people are not religious because they haven't had the opportunity or haven't taken it to really understand it. And so, you know, every institution has pluses and minuses. And, you know, I think we're encouraging people to think about what types of things would be helpful as they move forward. And it feels to me that we're suggesting things that wouldn't immediately draw them into any particular place, as my colleagues have said, and that could be freeing, too.
Pastor Don McKenzie is a former minister and head of staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ. Rabbi Ted Falcon is a teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. He's also the founder of Makom Or Shalom, a synagogue in Los Angeles, and Beit Olive Meditative Synagogue in Seattle. And Imam Jamal Rahman is co-founder, Muslim Sufi minister at Interfaith Community Sanctuary and adjunct faculty at Seattle University. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Katie.
This is Weekday.
Organic gardening advice from our panel of experts in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle section of the American Society of Civil Engineers, celebrating 100 years of service in the Pacific Northwest. The 2013 report card for Washington State's infrastructure has now been released. More information is online at seattleasce.org.
67 degrees in Seattle. It's sunny. Forecast says sun all day with a high of 77. You count on KUOW to provide you with intelligent reporting that nurtures your knowledge. KUOW takes you beyond the headlines and gives you a deeper perspective on important issues. Right now is a great time to renew your annual KUOW membership or make a special gift. You may have received a special appeal in the mail. Please mail back your gift or make it online at KUOW.org by June 30th. And thanks. James Holmes, the accused Aurora Theater shooter, has entered in court a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. That's in our top of the hour newscast, which is 25 minutes away.
It is Tuesday, and it is amazing out, or at least when I look through the video monitor of outside, it looks like it's amazing out. So it's a perfect time for people to be out working in the gardens and a perfect time to talk to our gardening panel. And here they are again in our studios to take your questions at 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. And I will now introduce you, because I forgot to do that, Laura Matter, practicing horticulturalist, the Garden Hotline Coordinator for Seattle Tilth. Deborah Prinzing is here, another special visit. She's a garden home and design writer. Her latest book is called The 50-Mile Bouquet. Greg Rayburn is the Vashon Basin steward and co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. And we will release the phone lines, like releasing the Kraken, so people can call 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869, or email us weekday at kuow.org. And Laura, I have to start with you, because my here's my question. My basil just all of a sudden started like drooping, like something ate it, but all the leaves are there.
Do you have it out in the garden already?
Yeah, it's not planted out. It's planted in a pot.
But outside.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the weather's been a little bit vacillating from coolness to warmth. Where warm this week would be better for basil. They are the most tender thing that we put out as an annual, so they may not be quite happy to be out there yet.
Okay.
Mine are sitting in my yard, too, and I have a few little black spots and a couple of leaves as they're acclimating.
Should I pull off those leaves?
I would leave them for the time being, let them grow a little bit, and then you can pull them off and eat what's good on them.
Because everything else looks happy. I mean, even the tomatoes, mm-hmm. which are now in 5-gallon pots.
Basil is the most tender of all. I usually don't put it really out into the full garden setting until early June, maybe not even today.
Well, you know, I sort of jumped the gun a few weeks ago when it was really nice out. I was thinking, this is it. This year I'm getting the basil. I have to confess, I don't start it from seed. I don't have any success at that. So I usually get the starts when the garden sales begin.
Right.
And then, so what am I supposed to do with
it? You hold on to it. You can put it in a sheltered area, put it in your window in the kitchen, somewhere sunny, keep it going, and then set them out.
Okay. It's too late, though, to bring it inside at this point.
Yeah, right? I wouldn't worry about it now. I think it's probably acclimating, but you're going to see a little bit of damage like I have on mine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cheer up, little basil. All right. So whether you're foolish like me and we're just anticipating that summer had come when it never comes to the Northwest, or maybe you are an ornamental gardener, or maybe you're a native plant gardener, our gardening panel is here. We've given them a little boost of time to answer your questions, because this is sort of it, right? Prime gardening season.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is when people dictate that they want to garden. Year-round is fantastic gardening, but with the plant sales, too. The plant sales are geared around when people want to buy plants, not necessarily the best time to plant whatever you're buying at the
sale. So maybe the plant sales are supposed to be in July?
Oh, no.
Maybe in the fall. I mean, yeah, they are some in the fall. Yeah,
but they aren't nearly the bulk of the sales happen in the spring when it starts to get warm and everybody wants to be out in their yard.
I know you like to be out in the rain bushwhacking, so you have no problem with that.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, this heat wave right now, I mean, I don't know how people are out there. enduring this.
Oh, woe is us. The sun is shining.
You might have to wear a sun hat, Greg.
Yes, exactly.
Well, you should wear a sun hat and sunscreen, and you can take us out with your podcast us or however you reach us. But right now, phone is best, 206-543-KUOW. Hi, Damon and Squim. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
So my wife and I live up in the mountains above Squim. We're at about 1,200 feet on a nice parcel of land. We're at the back end of a valley. We don't really get quite the rain shadow that proper Squim gets. But we're novice gardeners, put in our first garden this spring, about 3 weeks ago. We put in some tomato starts and planted some seeds. Of course, the spuds are doing remarkably well. But we've had a pretty heavy stretch of rain, I guess, up until about today. And the tomatoes are seeming to be quite yellow, and they seem like they're struggling. And we'd just like to know, like, what are some precautionary measures we can do? We're not terribly worried about the temperatures at night. It doesn't seem to be getting terribly cold, maybe mid-30s, but generally around 38, 39.
Burr.
That is a little cold for tomatoes. Actually, we recommend people, you know, aim for 50 degrees and above at night for tomatoes. But if you've got them out there, they're still alive. The yellowing, you know, is a sign of stress with them. A lot of rain can impede their progress. What kind of soil do you have them in? Did you use the native soil on your site, or did you build raised beds?
We use the native soil. Which was at one point a garden, some number of years ago, probably 15, 20 years ago. So
yeah.
We worked the soil for, I don't know, the better part of about a month before we put everything in.
Okay. So, you know, I would say check the soil, see how well it's draining. If it's staying soggy, that's certainly not good for them. They don't like to stay wet. Tomatoes typically like to be watered well but drained out, have the soil drained. So check the soil and see what's going on there. If you feel like it's still kind of wet and soggy even after we've dried out a little bit here, then you want to improve that. You can add some compost to that. You might even mound those beds a little bit so that you have better drainage. See if that helps. And it's okay. Not going to hurt to move them right now.
Oh, okay.
All right.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Thanks, Damon. Thanks for your call. He called 1-800-289-5869. I have to ask you this, Deborah, since we have you here as a special guest. I'm having visitors next week. My son is graduating from high school. And it seems to me that this is sort of the peak blooming time of year in the central Puget Sound region. Am I making that up?
Well, it's the beginning of the peak blooming time because I'm excited from now to the first frost, practically. We'll have something to harvest for bouquets. But yes, you should bring branches of flowering branches and perennials and bulbs and any wonderful foliage like your hosta foliage. Bring it indoors. And,
really?
Oh, hosta foliage is one of the greatest elements for a bouquet because it's that bold, dramatic, graphic shape that, you know, the uber hot designers love. And we've got it in spades in our garden. So
what do you have to do to keep it from shriveling and turning brown?
I don't really have trouble with it. It'll last in a vase 3 to 5 days. The trick with hostas is that the stems are short. So
yes.
So cut them as long as possible. A lot of people are afraid of, you know, harvesting from their garden. They think they're going to denude their beautiful ornamental beds and borders. Mm-hmm. But you can pick, you know, every other stem or something like that. you won't have a naked looking spot.
I feel like I should be celebratory about it all. And as Greg knows, I live in the shade. I live in a green belt and I have a lot of ferns. What if I brought those in? Would that work?
The more leathery leaf ferns are better than the tender ferns in terms of vase life. You know, that will be, I think that'd be a wonderful element to add. You could do an all foliage bouquet from your shade garden. You would knock people's socks off. It'd be gorgeous.
Yeah. Don't forget the evergreen huckleberry and slough are both extensively harvested for bouquets.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, whether you're making a bouquet or whether you're growing food, you can give a call to our gardening panel or email us weekday@kuow.org. Linda emailed quite some time ago, I have two whiskey barrels that have several rhubarb plants I got from my father-in-law 9 years ago after he passed away. I harvested some nice healthy rhubarb when it first began producing, but last year and this year, almost all the stalks are limp, thin, almost hollow, unusable. At times, I've given the plants fish fertilizer or steer manure. The manure just got added perhaps too late this year. Should I start with fresh soil, new plants? What do you advise?
I was, hopefully there's good drainage in that. That sometimes rhubarb gets, when it gets really wet, it can start rotting and you can have problems with it. So I hope there's lots of drainage holes in the bottom of the barrels. That'll help.
Does rhubarb just keep producing if it's happy?
It does. It does flower from time to time. And sometimes if you divide it, you know, you can kind of start over with it. But I'm kind of with Greg, you know, the drainage issue is a big one. And also when you start piling a lot of things around it, it's not a woody plant, but it doesn't really prefer to have a lot of materials piled up against it either. So. Mm.
Okay. Well, good luck with the, your father-in-law's plant. And maybe give it a little rest there. Laura in Magnolia, thank you for holding.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have a question about petunias. I seem to buy these hanging baskets every year, hoping that they will last kind of throughout the season. And then they eventually kind of, I don't know if they're being burned by the sun, but they kind of die halfway through the summer. And I see them at gardening stores, and they're just beautiful and blooming and never seem to die. So I don't know what I'm doing wrong, if they're just getting too much sun or they're rotting or...
Are they like half globe shape? I mean, they're kind of like a half circle hanging basket?
Yeah. Yes.
And then the... It's like a...
On the top where they kind of... Yeah, they're the flowers are hanging down. Mm-hmm. Definitely come down a bit. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. I mean, there's just... They are luscious when you see them in garden centers, and that's that they're at their peak at that moment.
But it amazes me because it seems like they last somehow.
Well, yeah, I mean, you see them in like downtown streets hanging off of lampposts in historic districts. They look amazing, and that's because they're getting hit with steroids a lot, and you know, kind of a water soluble fertilizer, a steady dose of it. Is one thing that I know that the municipalities are doing every single time they water those baskets. There's maybe a half strength fertilizer mixed into that water, but they can dry out very quickly, especially because they're hanging and they're susceptible to sun and wind and the elements. So you do need to water them practically daily, especially in our dry summers. Pinching off spent blooms, even though they're supposed to be self-cleaning, a lot of those petunias will, if you start cleaning them out and grooming them, you might actually appreciate the appearance a little bit more.
In my father's garden, he set up a little drip irrigation along the rafter that he would hang his flower, mm-hmm. his flaming or his hanging baskets from, and then that way it was really easy to put it on a timer and have it regularly watered.
Wow.
I would also point out that the ones you're seeing at the nurseries that look so good, remember that those are products for sale. So you're seeing new things each time, not ones that they've had there for months.
I was going to say, don't they repot and pull out the...
Well, they sell, and then they put a new one up. So, yeah.
The other thing is, if you have a dead spot, you can always just buy a little petunia six-pack and pop in little replacement blooms, because they do bloom. They should bloom all summer long if you can feed them with a low dose of fertilizer.
Good luck with that, Laura. Those are really cheerful. It is nice to have a hanging basket. We go from Magnolia to Crown Hill, where David's on the line. Hi, David.
Hi there. I have a veggie garden that we've been doing every summer and try to involve my toddler in helping us garden there. But one of the things we like to grow is arugula. And this year the arugula just seems to be really, so far, really bitter and spicy and almost inedible. And I don't know what we did wrong. The only thing that's different this year is we borrowed some compost from a neighbor. We have a whole bunch of volunteer turnips and a couple other things growing in there. But otherwise, it's the same thing we do every year, but this year it's just real spicy and bitter.
You know, different climatic things can affect the taste of veggies, you know, how much you water them, how much sun they're getting. Maybe nothing that you're doing, it just may be the conditions. You know, keep trying. You can keep planting arugula and, you know, keep sowing it out there and trying again. I would just keep doing that, see what happens.
Okay. The other thing is that there's I think we kind of planted more than normal, and so I haven't done a very good job of thinning them out. And I'm just wondering how soon should they be? Can they be clumped together? We kind of have a long line of arugula, or should there be space between each root?
I don't worry too much about them. They're kind of weedy little plants. They'll self-sow even, and you'll have them back again. So I don't really pamper them very much myself. I just actually harvested a whole ton of them at my food bank garden at Picardo Pea Patch, and some of the leaves were huge on there, and they were tasty. They were good, but they weren't really, you know, spaced evenly or anything. It was just sort of a bed full of them.
Willie used to suggest also cooking them to. You can stir fry
arugula to mellow the flavor a little bit.
Exactly.
Yeah, they were peppery anyway.
Yeah.
Sometimes, though, the hot weather makes things spicier than they might be. Good luck with that. And, David, it sounds like just pull it out and plant some more. That's the advice. We are talking gardening, as we do every Tuesday. Laura Matter is the hotline coordinator for Seattle Tilth. Deborah Prinzing is a garden home and design writer. Greg Rayburn is the Vashon Basin steward. And Kathy in Mukilteo has an issue that I have also. My lavender plant has white foam deposits on the stalks. I found some on my rock rows. Should I be concerned?
I think a little spray of water should take care of that.
I always call those spit bugs.
Yeah.
Isn't that what they are?
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably not what they are. But
before you blast them all off, go into that spit and look for the little bug. They're very alien-like life forms. They're fascinating.
Is that's a research thing that you're telling her to do, not
exactly.
Some kind of removal?
No, no. This
look
is
at his eyes glow. He's talking.
I do that.
Killing something, you have to get to know it.
I wasn't going
to
kill it. I was just going to give it a little shower.
Okay.
So enjoy looking at it. But they don't really wreck your plants, do they?
They can transmit viruses to plants, but, they in the scheme of things, they do less damage than many other insects.
I call them spit bugs.
Yeah,
that's not really the name, is it?
That's what I've referred to them as, but I know that's not correct. You know, the thing that this makes me want to comment on is that I'm so glad she asked what to do, because so many people see a bug activity on their ornamentals and their edibles, and they want to go find the remedy, some kind of chemical that they can spray. And really, sometimes it's just as simple as spraying a burst of water, or maybe getting some very mild safer soap or some kind of organic pesticide. I just think we have to live with a little imperfection.
And from my perspective, the garden itself is just a beautiful stage. Until you draw different life forms into it, you don't have any performers on the stage. So.
And that's why he loves those little spit bugs.
Exactly.
They're the bit players. Hi, Phyllis in Wallingford. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. My question is about fennel. I have a raised bed about 10 by 5 feet, and I was sick for a couple of years. So I just let the fennel grow. It's not the bulb type. It's a kind that has fronds, you know. And it reseeded and reseeded for a couple of years. And now I have, thousands of little fennel plants in there. They're about 2 inches tall.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried to pull them, but I thought I'd wait until they got larger. And I planted some squash plants in there, and they're not doing too well. But I want to kill all those fennel. How can I do it?
Well, I think pulling it is really the trick. They do have a long taproot, and getting the soil moist first will help you. And using like a garden fork or something you can loosen the soil up with will help you. And I just want to point out, I love fennel. I love to make fennel tea. I like to collect the seeds. But the fennel that you're talking about is actually a plant that is on the King County Noxious Weed list. It's not one required for control, but it's one that they're concerned about because it does spread like you're describing. And so if people are growing it, they should also be managing the seed heads on it. So harvest those things and use them for tea rather than, letting them seed. And I know you had a situation that you couldn't control, but just for everybody's edification.
So how should she get rid of it after she digs it out?
You can just put it in the yard waste bin.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Good
or
luck.
Or you can dry it and use it if you like fennel.
I was weeding all of my little seedlings that I received this year, even after removing a giant fennel plant from my garden that I inherited. You think that you get them all, but they are pretty, they're pretty insidious and easy to germinate. So I have probably hundreds of them. But boy, it smells good when you're pulling them out.
It does. Yeah, they smell fantastic. Good luck with that task, Phyllis. Maybe you want to get a friend to come and have a digging out the fennel party. We're talking gardening as we do every Tuesday in the 10 o'clock hour. Our guests, Greg Rayburn, Laura Matter, Deborah Prinzing, and we go next to Queen Anne, where Rex is on the line. Hi, Rex.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. So I have some two plum trees, slightly different varieties, I think, and I got them in sort of early fall last year, and they did great all through the winter, came out with a bunch of leaves in the spring, everything was going great, and then one of them about a month ago, the leaves started curling up, and then now the other one is starting, and the first one has, you know, all the things that were little plums, now these sort of just curled up mess of greenness, and I don't know how to help the tree get back to healthy.
Have you taken the leaves off and looked at them to see, is there maybe a leaf roller of some kind in there, or do you see webby material, or is it more of a disease looking
thing? Like, you mean like sometimes I've had caterpillar you know, sort of a web-looking stuff, or on other, on apple trees and things. But no, I didn't. It doesn't. I took a few of the leaves off, but then I was thinking, well, that I'll just take the unhealthy leaves off and it'll grow new leaves. But then I got worried it got so, you know, pervasive in the whole tree.
Yeah, I'm not, I don't know.
A lot of times when things are newly planted, they settle. So check the root zone of these trees and see if you could have soil or mulch that's sort of piled up against the base. I've seen that happen with newly planted things, and they start to grow and then they fail because they're getting suffocated, essentially, by having too much soil around the trunk. So check the root zone, make sure that's not going on. And then if that's fine, you know, you can always send samples off to the diagnostic laboratory in Puyallup, the WSU lab, and see if they can figure out if there's some kind of disease issue going on.
Good luck with that, Rex. Thanks for your call. We're talking gardening, and Noel writes, I rescued a wayward native hazelnut seedling several years ago. It has prospered, but it seems to be getting tall and sparse, and its foliage isn't as full and healthy as when it was smaller. Is there a way to prune it to get more compact and full-leaved?
Yeah, they can handle. They're usually a multi-stemmed trunk, so they can handle pruning quite well.
But not now, right?
No, I wouldn't do it during the spring months. That'd be something I'd do in the fall.
Okay, is there a special way to prune a hazelnut?
Well, if you're trying to get more branching and get a fuller look, then you'll take some of the taller leaders down. But generally, if you pick one stalk, and you don't want to remove more than, say, 25%, is because you don't want to stress it too much. And if it is actually a stressed-out plant rather than just a structural plant, you don't want to take out a large percentage of its canopy and have, you know, put too much stress on it.
Is this something that Plant Amnesty might have guidance on, or somewhere that this person can go to look?
Well, yeah, you can always check with plantamnesty.org. And they can refer you to arborists. I save that level of expertise for, say, a Japanese maple or something that's much
okay,
more
just hack ornamental or something pretty.
Native hazelnuts are pretty tough.
Okay. All right. So wait till fall, though, Noel, before you start cutting.
Or even during summer is okay, but okay. Generally you don't want to do
the
it.
New growth
right,
is coming out right
yes,
now.
Yes, exactly.
Maris in Bellevue is with us right now. Hi, Maris.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I have a question about weed control, and I try not to use pesticides. So but I'm really stumped by a couple of weeds in my yard. One of them is bindweed, and another one, I'm not actually sure of the name of this. I mean, I would call it a buttercup. It looks mm-hmm. got a little yellow five-petal mm-hmm. flower. And I just would love to know a way to try to get rid of these weeds that wasn't damaging to the environment.
It's called sweat equity. I have a friend who has trained her husband to follow her around the garden. She will mark all the buttercups, which is kind of funny, and then he will dig them.
Wow.
They have to, they're, do you have clay soil?
Yes.
They really love to knit themselves into that clay soil. I don't know, is there a better way to remove them than digging them?
Well, they are, the thing that both those weeds have in common are that they have spread by rhizomes. It's important to get as much of the root as possible, which, of course, in clay is difficult. And then the other thing is if you just, like with the bindweed, if you just keep pulling it and tugging on it, that seems to just anger it, and it seems to come back with twice as many new sprouts. So one technique that I've heard recommended with success is to keep a pair of scissors in a baggie. Marianne Benetti recommended this one. Keep the scissors in a baggie out by the bindweed. And each time you're out there, just snip it off at the ground. That way you're not dividing the rhizome, and eventually you can really starve it out. But it's one of those things that you go on vacation during the summer for a few weeks and you come back and it's had a chance to renew its stores. So
Horsetail's the other one that mm-hmm. sort of they're endless. It's one plant and it just circles the globe. So Marissa, it sounds like get the baggie, the scissors, and diligent and train somebody to follow you around and dig it up. I love that. Good luck with that. Last question from Chris. I have a couple fairly large ferns I'd like to transplant. They're fully leafing out right now. Is it okay to transplant them now, or do I need to wait till fall?
I don't like to transplant this late in the season generally, but if you do, you have to be on top of the watering.
Okay.
That's the main reason why.
But wait,
fall is a great time to transplant.
Greg Rayburn is the Vashon Basin steward. He co-hosts King County TV's Yard Talk. Laura Matter is a practicing horticulturalist, the Garden Hotline coordinator for Seattle Tilt. Deborah Prinzing writes about garden, home, and design. Her latest book is The 50-Mile Bouquet. Thanks to all of you, and
thanks
to all our listeners. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette's our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Join us tomorrow in the 9 o'clock hour. We talk with author Khaled Hosseini here on Weekday on KUOW.
Gene Godden has had two successful careers, one as a newspaper reporter and columnist, and one as a member of the Seattle City Council. KUOW's Ross Reynolds is going to talk with Gene Godden about her careers and her life today at noon. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Washington's Lottery, supporting the Washington Opportunity Pathways account to help fund higher education scholarships in Washington. More at walottery.com.
With all the hype about the attitudes about blacks and marriage, you might think you've heard it all, but a new survey on African-American life offers new insights.
We were particularly surprised, for example, by one finding about the dating lives of black single men versus black single women.
A new Harvard NPR poll on black attitudes about marriage and more. That's next time on Tell Me More.
That's this afternoon at 1 o'clock on KUOW's second program service, KUOW2. Snohomish County's new executive... Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.